It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
There have been recent changes in Virginia state law that the university must comply with, which mean that places where they formerly could gain confidential advice on grounds are no longer so confidential. Many of the people on grounds who would like to help them in that way are now mandated reporters to law enforcement. So in some ways, just going to the people that you would like to go to at the university can result in a train leaving the station before you're prepared for what that might entail.
The most important thing is that the survivor be given their choice back. The power and control of their own lives has been taken from them, and we want to give that back to them.
CVLAS attorney Palma Pastelnik and Sexual Assault Advocacy Fund, or SAFE, Services Coordinator Kelly Wells talk about campus sexual assault and a new organization to handle it, Student SAFE, the first of its kind in the country. And during this week's News You Can Use, we explain how Virginia can celebrate the Medicaid 50th anniversary by closing the coverage gap. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show was supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 274, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. On its 50th anniversary, it's important to remember that the Medicaid program has helped make millions of Americans healthier by improving access to preventive and primary care and by providing care for serious diseases. Medicaid also covers most of the nursing home and other long-term care services needed by Americans. In Virginia, about 1 million people have Medicaid insurance. They are primarily children, pregnant women, seniors, and people with disabilities. But, unlike 30 other states and the District of Columbia, Virginia legislators are continuing to block new Medicaid coverage for uninsured adults. The state has already forfeited billions of dollars, federal taxes we have already paid. This affects hundreds of thousands of low-income Virginians who are mostly working in important sectors of the economy, such as tourism, construction, and retail, but who don't have access to affordable health insurance on the job or from the federal marketplace. Currently, Virginia parents can get Medicaid only if they are extremely poor. Medicaid eligibility for working parents cuts off at just $12,132 per year for a family of four in Northern Virginia, $9,324 per year for a family of four in most cities, and only $7,980 per year for a family of four in most rural parts of the state. The lowest income level is only 33% of the federal poverty line. As a result, a poor parent loses Medicaid if he or she works more hours or takes a higher-paying job. If parents earn $13,000, $17,000, or $24,000 per year, they fall into Virginia's health coverage gap and do not qualify for health insurance. It's even worse for adults who don't have minor children. If they aren't pregnant, disabled, or over age 65, Virginia adults cannot get Medicaid at all, even if they have zero income. But in the states that have adopted health reforms, Medicaid expansion, such as West Virginia and Kentucky, poor adults can earn substantially more and still get Medicaid. The eligibility limit in those states is $16,243 per year for an individual, or $33,465 per year for a family of four, which is 138% of the poverty line. If income rises above this amount, the adult can get subsidized coverage through the health insurance marketplace. Virginia must close the coverage gap to allow hundreds of thousands of Virginia's hardworking, uninsured adults to secure the health coverage they need. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the offices of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society in Charlottesville, and we are speaking with Palma Pastolnik, a staff attorney here, and Kelly Wells, who is the Sexual Assault Advocacy Fund, or SAFE, Services Coordinator, and we will be speaking with both of them today about the Safe Services Project. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you, Marty. It's good to be here.
I wanted to start off by having one of you tell our listening audience exactly what is SAFE, the Sexual Assault Advocacy Fund.
The Sexual Assault Advocacy Fund was started by an alum of the University of Virginia in response to the Rolling Stone article last fall. She read the article, and within hours, she had started a fundraising webpage because she was very concerned that survivors of sexual assault did not have legal representation to assist them in navigating the different options that they might have in dealing with the aftermath of their assault.
So as I understand, the SAFE Project deals pretty much exclusively with sexual assault on campus?
Not necessarily on campus, but for students.
So how big a problem is sexual assault on our college campuses?
Sexual assault is a huge problem on all campuses across the country. It's not a UVA sole issue. It's an issue across the nation, but we're trying to address this issue by giving survivors more options and more ability to find out those options in a confidential setting.
If someone is a victim, survivor of sexual assault, what is the first thing that person should do?
Our first advice to them would be to go to the University of Virginia Medical Center or seek medical treatment wherever they're close to, and if they're willing, to complete a sexual assault nurse examination, the PERC kit for physical evidence recovery, if that's something they're interested in. And then their next call should be to us to talk about all the services that are available.
And what services are available from the SAFE Project?
A student who contacts us would, as quickly as possible, be scheduled to have a meeting with both Kelly, our Safe Services Coordinator, and me, the attorney that would be working with them, so that they can get a comprehensive understanding of what different actions that they could take are and what different things could result from those actions. So, for example, they have the option of reporting it to the university and either participating or choosing not to participate in whatever actions the university chooses to take based on that report. They can seek counseling, and there are many different places where we can recommend and refer for counseling. They can make a criminal report, and we can assist with that, with helping them access the police department and trained investigators there. We can also assist them with gaining a civil protective order through the courts here in Charlottesville, Albemarle, so that their assailant would be restrained by law from being in contact with them. And a violation of that kind of order is a criminal act, in addition to assisting them with different university actions, which could include a no-contact order through the university. It could include going through the formal complaint system, which would result in an investigation at the university, which could result in a finding of responsibility for their assailant, which could have ramifications anywhere from some sort of academic suspension to expulsion. So there are a wide range of choices, and very few of them are able to be made in a vacuum anymore. There have been recent changes in Virginia state law that the university must comply with, which mean that places where they formerly could gain confidential advice on grounds are no longer so confidential. Many of the people on grounds who would like to help them in that way are now mandated reporters to law enforcement. So in some ways, just going to the people that you would like to go to at the university can result in a train leaving the station before you're prepared for what that might entail.
So is that one of the primary reasons why you would advise a survivor of sexual assault who's a student on campus to come to the Safe Services Project first rather than go to the university first?
Absolutely. That would be our goal, is that we could talk them through what each process looks like before they have made a decision that then results in an outcome that they're not seeking, so that we can discuss all of their different outcomes, what they would like to see happen, and point them in the right direction of what options are available.
And who are mandated reporters on the University of Virginia campus, or for that matter, any campus? Is it anyone that a survivor speaks to, or only certain people?
Basically, anyone that a survivor speaks to that is on staff or faculty of the university that would not otherwise have a professional privilege under Virginia law, such as a counselor of some sort, like a doctor or a nurse at the hospital, anybody besides that, any of the deans, any of the other folks who do not carry a legal privilege, must report in some way or another, often with identifying information.
So you've given us good reasons why a survivor of sexual assault would want to come to the Safe Services Project first, just because, as you said, the train hasn't left the station. How would a survivor access our Safe Services Project?
Well, they would call Kelly.
Yes, they would call me directly. My direct line is 434-327-1447, and then we would go through the intake procedure to make sure they qualify for services at Central Virginia Legal Aid, and assuming that they do, and most students do, we would then take it from there with meeting with the student personally. If that's what something they would like, they can come to our office, we can meet them somewhere, and we can also discuss options by phone.
And what are the eligibility rules to get services from Central Virginia Legal Aid Society, just in brief?
Well, the first thing is to make sure that we don't have a conflict like with any law firm. So we would have to check on both their name and their assailants to make sure that we don't have a legal conflict. Assuming that we do not, because this falls under the purview of domestic violence VAWA exceptions, the person is allowed to have income up to 200% of poverty level, which for a single household, which most students would be, even if you have an apartment with roommates, you're still viewed as a single household if you're not supporting each other. That's about $1,250 a month in income. So your parents' income doesn't count. If you happen to live with your assailant, your assailant's income and assets do not count. If you have open access already to a trust fund, that might be an issue, but certainly call us. We can go through that and find out if it's an issue. But for the most part, most students will qualify.
And of course, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society is a federally funded legal aid program, has to follow federal funding rules. One of them has to do with citizenship. Is that going to be an issue for anyone?
Fortunately, again, because of domestic violence and VAWA exceptions, the exception to the requirement for citizenship or documentation does not cover domestic violence, sexual violence situations. So even if you are undocumented, you can call us and we can help.
Can one of you define for us, what do you mean by sexual assault?
In terms of this program, we're talking about anything that would be violative of the university's sexual misconduct policy. And so that involves sexual intercourse or sexual touching without consent, that involves rape, that involves domestic violence situations. So if your boyfriend is beating you, he doesn't have to rape you for us to help you. An assault in a domestic situation is also something that we can help with, even if it's not a sexual assault.
Now, earlier you mentioned some of the options that a survivor has, both within the university and also outside of the university. Lead us through that. Let's assume that a survivor wants to pursue her options within the university after speaking with the two of you. Lead us through that process. What happens step by step?
Well, and we would hope that once a student is able in a safe environment like ours to go through and think about all of and evaluate all of their different options, that because by the very nature of their situation, there's some sort of predator out there, that we would hope that a decision could be made, that a report of some sort could be made. There are a number of different vehicles for reporting. One is anonymous, and others are more in person and involve more information being provided to the university. In a more extensive situation, what would happen is the survivor would go to the dean's office at Peabody Hall and make a report what happened and who the assailant was and when it happened, and that would launch an investigation. And we are now under what is the new policy since March 30th at the university, where the investigators go through, they speak to any pertinent witnesses, they collect any pertinent information both from the complainant and from the accused. Their preliminary report is shared with both parties, who are then able to supplement that with any other additional information, either names of additional witnesses or more material that they think is pertinent and relevant. Then the investigators evaluate that on a preponderance of the evidence standard and determine whether they believe that the accused should be held responsible or found guilty of the alleged assault. And then at that point, a board of trained faculty and staff is convened to determine what the sanction should be. And that sanction, as I mentioned earlier, can range anywhere from some sort of academic suspension to expulsion. And there would then be a notation on the academic record of the accused that they were found responsible for a violation of the sexual misconduct policy. If the accused is found not responsible or not guilty, the complainant can appeal. If the accused is found responsible or they get a sanction that they think is inappropriate, they can appeal. But this is more of a procedural appeal than just a straight up, I didn't like the verdict. So,
what is your role, the two of you, role in all of this investigation?
Well, one of the most important parts that we can assist with is in presenting the information to the investigators. And again, this is why it's so important that we be involved at the very beginning, because to present the case properly, you need somebody who knows how to present a case properly. And for the most part, somebody who's just been through this sort of an experience, no matter what their prior training may be, is not prepared to go this alone. And so going through what all may have happened, what different things may be useful, whether it's text messages or Facebook messages or different friends who may have seen contemporaneously the reaction, whether the sane nurse at the hospital can describe your demeanor to investigators in addition to presenting the results of your kit. These are things that you need somebody who understands this process to help walk you through it.
And would I be correct that those medical records from right after the assault, those are certainly accessible by the survivor? I suppose you, the two of you, would be key in getting those records and reviewing them to see how strong the case it is.
And frankly, those records, it depends on what sort of assault we're talking about. I mean, certainly they will indicate whether or not it appears that sexual activity occurred. It is unusual, unless it's a particularly brutal assault, for the medical personnel to be able to determine and opine that force was involved. But again, under the sexual misconduct policy, force is not essential in determining guilt, because lack of consent or lack of ability to consent is a violation. If somebody engages in sexual activity for somebody who is, for example, blacked out, That's a sexual assault.
So blood alcohol content would be a key factor there.
It would, and that's another reason why speaking to us and getting the Sexual Assault Resource Agency involved right away as well. And those are folks, that's for those of you who deal in acronyms, that's SARA. They are a local organization that is wonderful. They will pick you up and take you to the hospital if you need it. They will meet you there and hold your hand if you think that support is helpful. They will get you wherever you need to be, and they will help you access counseling as well. They are a great local organization. What you need to understand is that there are different ways that you can approach the gathering of the evidence in a sexual assault examination. And you can choose to have an anonymized report so that they don't have to report it to police. Unfortunately, at this time, because of the way in which anonymous packages are kept, they are not kept under refrigeration because there's a limited ability to do that, which means things like blood alcohol content and whether or not there may have been drugs involved or anything like that are not able to be preserved. So that's a big issue. Neither is DNA. So those are things that are going to guide some of your decision-making process. Of course, if you want those things kept, then the report will be made to the police. So again, train starts leaving the station. So those are decisions to be made. We are working with the police and the university medical personnel in trying to get it to the point where the anonymized reports can also have that much more evidence preserved, at least for a short time.
And then you also mentioned remedies that are outside of the university system. Just in brief, what would those remedies be? What would a survivor do to invoke those?
So, of course, any survivor, and this is not exclusive, you can go through the UVA process and the criminal process as well as the civil process, but there's also, of course, criminal prosecution, which would require making a report to the local law enforcement and having them do their own independent investigation. But Palma and I can, of course, accompany the survivor to do that, to help guide them through that process. But then that can result in criminal charges ranging anywhere from assault, sexual battery, to rape. And then, of course, they have the independent option of a civil protective order to ensure that the accused has no contact with them during this interim time period. And that can be in addition to a no contact order at the university or separate from the no contact order at the university. And that continues to be in effect even when neither party or one of the parties is no longer a student at the university.
And could you lead us briefly through the process of getting that protective order?
So we would recommend that the survivor, of course, contact us first so that we can go with them to complete the paperwork for that process. But they would go to the clerk's office and fill out paperwork requesting a protective order. They would then have a hearing before the judge when Palma could represent them on an attorney basis as far as providing them with the information they need to present to the judge to hopefully get the order. And then after the protective order is entered, there would be a full hearing on the protective order where the accused would have the right to be present and address the protective order, and the judge would determine whether it meets the statute requirements to issue the full 2-year protective order.
And what if a survivor comes to you and comes to you first, and after talking with either or both of you, decides to do nothing? What then?
Of course, our desire would be that some action is pursued because, again, we do have a violent person who is in our community. We want to address that. But at the same time, the most important thing is that the survivor be given their choice back. The power and control of their own lives has been taken from them, and we want to give that back to them. And if they know all of the options available to them and make an informed decision to not pursue any options, that's perfectly valid, and they're welcome to do that. The clock on the university process is a little more strict in that they can only take action when either or both parties are university students. However, the criminal process and the civil protective order do not have those kind of restraints, but there is still timetables to take into account. So we just want to make sure that people have their options and know what their choices are as soon as possible, and then can make whatever choice they think is most appropriate for their situation.
And where should people go to learn more about sexual assault, especially sexual assault on campus?
Well, of course, they can go to the university website under their sexual misconduct policy. They can also visit our website, studentsafe.org. That's studentsaaf.org for more information. And they can, of course, also contact me at 434-327-1447 for more information about the program and the policies.
Well, thank you very much. We have been speaking with Palma Pistolnik. She's a staff attorney at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society in our Charlottesville office, as well as Kelly Wells. She is the SAFE, that stands for Sexual Assault Advocacy Fund, services coordinator about the new SAFE project that is just starting at the University of Virginia for University of Virginia students who are survivors of sexual assault. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you, Marty.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Last week, the Virginia General Assembly deadlocked over congressional redistricting. Join us next week when we present an overview on redistricting from the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy, the Virginia Coalition for Immigrant Rights, and One Virginia 2021. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.